Let's turn in our Bibles to the 20th chapter of the book of Deuteronomy as we continue our studies in Deuteronomy at these laws that were given to govern Israel's life as a nation in the land of promise. Again, these are commandments given by Moses to the people before they entered into the land of promise. And we're in a section in which there's a number of commandments that are given that anticipate certain situations. In fact, that's really the pattern of what you're going to see in chapter 20 into chapter 21, and even in the various laws that are given thereafter. Situations are placed before the minds of the people. When this happens, then you do this. When this occurs, then you do this. If this is the state of things, then this is the way in which this problem is to be handled. And so the law of God is the general laws of equity and proper conduct that God gave to Israel, summarized in the Ten Commandments. Those what we called, remember the word we gave for those laws, the big ones? If you were here in the morning, we discussed it. I'll remind you, they're apodictic. They're apodictic laws. Those are the laws that really come out from the Ten Commandments that are supplied in all situations. That's what morality in all cases requires. And then the ones that are applied to given situations are called, anybody recall? I don't think you would, but that's all right. Was it?
Casuistic.
They're the casuistic laws. You know, sometimes you hear the old Puritans are called, they were doctors of casuistry. In other words, when people came to them with problems, they were able to take the general principles of the law of God, apply it to situations of living, and tell people the things they ought to be doing, at least the options of what ought to be right conduct, what the options would be. That's called casuistry, being able to be good counselors, basically, what that one's all about, taking the law of God, the things that are taught us in Scripture, and applying it to given circumstance. Now, I also mentioned that this is sort of following the pattern of the Ten Commandments, both with respect to, you had commands with reference to worship, the first and second commandment. You had commandments with respect to leaders, the fifth commandment. And now we have laws with respect to loss of life, the sixth commandment. And we saw some of those in chapter 19, the laws concerning cities of refuge, making a distinction between manslaughter and deliberate murder. And then witnesses who take, whose witnesses are being brought into capital cases, and how that's to be determined and decided, and what we call the lex talionis, the law of revenge that's expressed. Well, right after that, interestingly enough, there are laws concerning not personal vengeance, not personal problems of taking life, but the community taking life at war. There's laws concerning battling the enemy in war. And it's assumed that Israel was going to have its wars. It's not commanded to go to war against your enemies. There was commands with reference to the seven nations of Canaan that they were to go and battle against. But when they entered into the land, they were not commanded to have wars of aggression. But there was thought there would probably be some. And there would be wars of defense that the people were called upon to face. There would be some of those as well. And God has instructions for his people what they are to do when war is faced, when it's necessary, when it's required, when you go out to war against your enemies, when you see what's up against you, the horses and the chariots and an army larger than your own. And when you look at that reality square in the eye, the tendency will be to do what?
Shrink back,
because you are afraid. There is fear. There is facing the enemy with the sense that we will lose our lives. We will lose our homes. We will lose our wives. We will lose our children. We will lose everything that's dear to us and precious to us. And therefore, the people of Israel are afraid in the face of the enemy. And God's concern is to quell the fear and to give them a proper basis for fighting the war fearlessly with their confidence, again, not in armament, it's not in military might, it's not in chariots, it's not in their alliances with other nations, but their confidence is to be in Him. He says, I'm sorry?
The Lord.
In the Lord, absolutely. Confidence is to be in the Lord. He says, you shall not be afraid of them, for the Lord your God is with you, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. Remember who your God is. Remember what He's done for you. Remember how He destroyed the greatest empire of the world then, the Egyptian Empire. Brought the plagues upon them, crushed their armies in the Red Sea. You saw what God did to the Egyptians. God is still your God. He will not leave you. He will not forsake you. And so, when you go out to war, and you see these adversaries, and you're afraid, first of all, don't fear, but there's something else you got to do. There's something else you got to do. There's a means to quell the fear in the hearts of God's people. It says that when you draw near to battle, the priest shall come forward and speak to the people and shall say to them. There's a priestly speech or a priestly oration that's to be given to the nation as they're poised to go to battle in war. Israel is to be a nation before God with whom the priests have an important role to play, even in the military. Not just the chaplaincy, the priests are to be God's messenger to the people to remind them of God's own promises to them. And so when you draw near to the battle, verse 2 says, the priest shall come forward and speak to the people. And God gives the priest the words to say. This is actually what they are to say. Every time Israel was to go out and face an adversary in war, the priests would come forth and they were to, I don't know that they did this all the time. Probably lots of times they didn't do it. Maybe a lot of times they didn't do it and they lost as a result of it. Maybe there was kings that thought they could get on without priestly prayers, without priestly words of encouragement and comfort. Maybe they didn't need the Lord at all, as they're always looking to make alliances with other nations. But a godly leader is going to be certain that a priest is in their midst, and the priest in their midst will fulfill this word of God's own command, that when you go out to war and you fear the enemy, the priest will come forward, and the priest will speak to the people, and the priest will say to them these very words. And it's interesting, it's very similar to the Shema, at least it begins in the very words, Hear, O Israel, Hear, O Israel. It's like the daily prayer of the people was to be, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. The daily confession, Hear, O Israel, gains the attention of the nation. Their identity as Israel, one who strives with God, is now to go out and strive against the enemy. Today, you are drawing near for battle against your enemies. Let not your heart faint. Do not fear or panic or be in dread of them. For the Lord your God is He who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies to give you the victory. I remember when we used to say, well, America's never lost a war. Never lost a war. I guess you call Korea a stalemate of some sort, and I'm not sure what you call Vietnam. When you saw the people taken off of our embassy roofs to be helicoptered out to safety, and the South taken over by the North Vietnamese, I'm not really sure what you think of Iraq and the aftermath of ISIS taking over that nation and many of the cities and places our soldiers died to defend. I just don't think we can really say any longer we're a nation who has not been defeated in war. I think it's not because we couldn't win those battles, but we didn't have the resolve. We didn't have the resolve. Well, Israel was to have the resolve, and they would have the resolve and the knowledge of the presence of their God who would give them the victory. And if they had obeyed, if they had been faithful, if they had been believing, there was never a war Israel would ever have lost. God would have given them the victory. And we've seen that, haven't we, in the book of Isaiah, of the two kings, one who would not believe and did not trust in the Lord and was always making alliances against his enemies, and that was Ahaz in chapter 7, and then the contrast with Hezekiah. And Hezekiah is backed up in the midst of a city under siege, and he calls for the prophet, and he cries unto God. He lays before the Lord the letter of the Rabshakeh, and what does God do? God brings confusion amongst the armies of the Assyrians, and hundreds of thousands of their soldiers perished. I'm sure I got the number right, but you know, a great host perished as a result. God was among the people, and faithful, believing kings would have known the help and the triumph of the Lord. It's not a question of maybe or if. He goes with you to fight for you against your enemies to give you the victory. And again, that's where he's believed in. That's when he's looked to. That's when he's trusted in. That's when the people are faithful before him. God will be in their midst. There's a real sense, folks, we're in battle constantly. Sometimes we don't even know it or aware of it, but the martial imagery that the New Testament uses of the Christian life is pretty clear that we are in a battle. It's not the same kind of battle Israel would engage in when they went to war against their enemies, because that was a battle against flesh and blood. That had to do with chariots and armament and military might and the rest. But we're in a battle nonetheless, against flesh, not against flesh and blood, but against the principalities and the powers and the spirits that dwell in the high places that have enmity against God and his people, demonic forces, the forces of evil that's elusive this world through demonic powers, and we're called upon to resist them. We're called upon in the power of the armament that God himself supplies to engage in that warfare for the Christian life. And the victory is ours, folks. We're told we're more than conquerors through him that loved us. But again, that presupposes we're strong in the Lord and the power of his might. That's what precedes that whole exhortation in Ephesians chapter 6 about the armament of God. It says, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. You can't resist the enemy in the stuff of your own wisdom and the stuff of your own strength by plotting out the plans for yourself. You got to be submitting unto God. And the constant call of Scripture is for our submission to him, our reliance upon him, our trust in him, our being clothed in the resources and power that he himself gives. And the result of that is we are more than conquerors because of Christ who loved us and gave himself for us. Well, that's the command of the priests. Any questions about that? What the priests are to do? But it's interesting. It moves on to say that then there's something of a winnowing of the troops. Kings don't tend to do this.
It's pretty hard to say, do not be afraid, because he doesn't promise them that nothing will happen to them. It's not without, you know, because later on he goes on to talk about, you know, some may die because, you know, if you haven't with your wife, if you haven't gotten
over
your crops and so on.
Again, you know, so much of the question of fear really has to do with love. Perfect love casts out all fear. And, you know, people tend to go to war with valor when they have something they love that they're concerned to defend and protect. And if someone is consumed with the thought that this is God's battle, it's his war against his enemies, and out of love to him, as well as love to my homeland, the nation that God has given us, if there's a religious component to that, and then something bigger than yourself, something greater than yourself, I think that principle tends to kick in. I think that's why the priests would come in their midst and remind them that God is in their midst. He will fight for you. You won't be defeated. I guess even if your life is given, it's a life that's given for something greater than you are. I mean, we're all going to die. Every one of us are going to die. And the question is, what are we living for, and what do we feel is worth dying for? And but then the officers give something of an answer to Don's question, although I think that first the priestly oration does have something to do with emboldening the troops I think that, that it does when you're resting upon the reality of a present God in your midst, of the God who defeated the Egyptians, the God who will defeat your enemies for you. I think that's something that will give courage to the hearts of the warriors, especially those who are trained, whose hands are trained for war. You know, I don't, and I think this is interesting. What follows is that God is pleased to winnow the troops because of two realities. Number one, that there's other things in life that are worthy to be pursued other than battles, other than warfare. And secondly, that there are other people who are gifted to do other things rather than warfare, and probably they shouldn't be in the armies if they're not equipped to do it. Again, that's where I have a great preference in my own mind for a volunteer military, having been a draftee myself, having served as a draftee. I mean, I would have gone out and I would have done my duty as a soldier, and I would have recognized that there was a responsibility I had as a Christian to give a good account of my faith, even unto death. But yet, I was not someone whose hands are trained for war. I mean, I'm just not put together that way. Some of these guys will run to the front of the battle. And I'm not going to run back necessarily, but I don't know that I'm going to run to the front of the battle. I don't know that I have that mentality. Although maybe in a battle, I might do that very thing out of love. Because I think love is the principal thing. If you have the sense you're defending your loved ones, you're defending the people that are important to you, that you got flesh in this game, this is something important for you to protect, you will be very courageous. Perfect love will cast out all fear. But yet not everybody is trained to be a soldier. It is something that I believe is a calling. I believe men of arms who make a career of the military are special people, constructed in special ways to do special work that I have a great deal of respect for and regard for. Think of the great statement of George Orwell. I probably won't get it right, but you know, thankful he was that there are rough men who are willing to do the things that most of us would never think to do, that we can sleep at peace in our beds. I'm thankful for such men who do those rough things that we ourselves would recoil from. And yet they run to the battle to do those things that we can be sleeping at peace in our beds. I didn't get that quote absolutely correct, but that's the general notion and idea of what Orwell said. But there is God telling the people that there is no, a need for other things to even take priority over the battles of the nation. He goes on to say, in verse 5, "Then the officers shall speak to the people, saying..." And I think there's like four different scenarios that are placed before before the officers. Where they say, first of all, is there any man who has built a new house and is not, it says dedicated it, but I think that that's probably not the best understanding. He hasn't lived in it. He's gotten the house and he's just not had an opportunity to dwell in the very house that he has built. And the war is declared, messengers go forth, and he's... called away to go to the battle. Well, the officer's saying, you built the house, you ought to have an opportunity to live in it. That even takes priority, God says, over going to the battle. And again, this is God's army. God's army is constructed on different principles, but I think there's a certain reality here that there are things that do require exemptions. There are things that should require exemptions. Here's one instance of it. Go live in your house, at least for a time. Yes?
Isn't that the same kind of understanding that the Bible says that the farmer is the first one to receive of his crops?
Yeah, he has the right to receive of his crops. Yeah, God's concern is, that those who labor not in vain. He has labored to build his house. It shouldn't be that he labors in vain. Let him go live in it, at least for a while, at least for a year. Let them have the benefit of living in the house, God says. Something's more important than the battles of the kings. Something's more important. The man who built a house ought to have the opportunity to live in it. God cares about people being able to enjoy the labors of their hands, the fruit of that labor. So let him go back to the house. Unless he die in the battle and another man come and live in the house that he has made. Let him go live in it. Now, there's another place. I mean, he's going to talk about a man who takes a wife, but I think it was in the first year of marriage that the people of Israel were not to be conscripted by the kings into battle. A man who's newly married ought to live at least 1 year with his wife. So maybe from that principle, at least let him live a year in his house before he's going off to fight the nation's wars. And then here's a man who's planted a vineyard, and he's not enjoyed his fruit. Let him go back to his house, lest he die in the battle, and another man enjoy its fruit. And is there a man who has betrothed a wife and has not taken her? Let him go back to his house, lest he die in the battle, and another man take her. So again, Don's right. God's not promising you won't die in battle. But he wants people to die in battle, having lived lives of some measure of fullness, in terms of marrying a wife and being able to enjoy life with his wife at least for a year, living in his house perhaps for a year, enjoy the fruit of the crops that he planted. So the people are to be told that they have the right to enjoy those things. Not even the king's battles take precedence over these men's opportunity to enjoy these things. Now, it's interesting, in the Gospels, there are people that came to Jesus with an excuse and said, well, I married a wife, or I bought a land, or I've done this and I've done that. And they're putting that forth as an excuse. And, you know, Jesus, first of all, Jesus is not insensitive to people's desire to possess those things. And in fact, following Jesus probably would not mean giving up your wife. It would not mean giving up your life. But they're making excuses not to do his will and to engage in the radical discipleship he's called them to because of those very things. Here the scenario is not that people are complaining, oh, I married a wife, or I did this, or I did that. This is God expressing his concern. Here's not the language of excuse. This is the language of grace, of God's goodness, of telling the people, telling the leaders of the people, that people ought to enjoy the benefits of this life before they enter into battle, when these conditions exist. It goes on to say, and the officer shall speak further to the people and say, is there any man who is fearful and faint-hearted? And this, I assume, is after the priestly oration. The priests have spoken. The priests have said, don't fear. Here's the basis of not fearing. God's in your midst. God's going to give you the victory. And yet somehow, all the persuasion of the priests doesn't really do much to help this poor fellow out. So what do you do? Do George Patton, George E. Scott, going up to the coward and slapping him about. You all saw that movie, didn't you? I'm the only one. Patton's one of the great movies. But anyway, that's what he did. And he got himself into trouble because he slapped a coward. He went and he hit him. Well, God says, don't hit the coward. Don't hit the coward. Have pity upon this poor man. Not everyone's called to be a soldier. Not everyone is constitutionally put together to go to war. They have the skills, they have the mentality, they have the ability to do what others do. There are differences among men and different gifts among men and different... And that has to be acknowledged. And sadly, in draft armies, it's not everyone. Just take the kid. He's 18, he's strong enough, let him go, let him serve. Well, anyway, the officer shall speak further to the people and say, is there anyone who is fearful, faint-hearted? Let him go back to his house. And here's the concern. Lest the fearful man make the heart of his fellows melt like his own. When they see fear in his eyes, that's something that could become a little bit contagious. You don't want this fearful fellow influencing the others in a way of having his fears become their fears, his dread becoming their dread. Let's have an army of committed men who are going out to pursue the battle with the courage and the confidence that God is in their midst, that they're doing this for their home, their country, and they're confident they'll do the work and God will give them the victory, and eventually they'll come back home to their families without having the person in their midst that's causing fear to run rampant through the camp. It says, when the officers have finished speaking to the people, the commander shall be appointed at the head of the people. And I think this is interesting. Remember how Gideon whittled down the numbers of the troops when he went up against the Midianites? And that's what he did first. He sent all the fearful folks home first. That was the first thing. And then he had them drink the water. And some of them just went and they put their head down in the water and just started to lap. And others scooped it up and put it and began to lick from their hands. And it was from that small number that did the latter action that he said, here are the few good men. Here are the vigilant ones. Here are the guys that are not going to be just putting their head down and then getting their heads lopped off because they weren't looking about and watching to see what was around. The guy that scooped it up and he's looking about, he's being vigilant. Those are the guys who could be my warriors. And there's just 300 of them. And yet it was no hindrance to God to save by many or by few. That's what Jonathan said. God's able to use a few good men and accomplish his purpose, because the battle ultimately is not that you have a superior force. The battle ultimately depends upon the fact that God is in the midst of the armies. Does that make sense? Comments or questions about... Yes?
The thing with the coward person is it affects other people. That's like a little leaven leaven the whole lump, right?
Yep, that's part of... Yeah, yeah, that's one of the images that it's given, how things just tend to wind their way through from person to person to person. Evil will do that. Cowardice will do that. Fearfulness will do that. It's funny, even yawning will do that. You know that old game. Somebody starts to yawn and soon everybody's yawning, or go look up. Everybody else just looks up. We're very imitative creatures along those lines. It just seems to be the things that happen. Now there's another situation that is put forward, another when instance. When you draw, this is in verse 10, when you draw near to a city to fight against it, here's the first thing you do. You offer terms of peace to it. And if it responds to you peaceably, and opens to you, then all the people who are found in it shall do forced labor for you and shall serve you. So, but you're not to go and look to kill anybody or take people's lives. They're to be like the... was the people that came amongst the Israelites that became carriers of water and hewers of wood, because they entered into covenant with them. Well, that's the scenario. They shall be part of the workforce. You've subdued them. They're vassal states under you, but their lives are to be protected. They're to be safe, and yet they're to labor for you. If it makes no peace with you, if it makes war against you, then you go to war and besiege it. And when the Lord your God gives it into your hand, you shall put all of its males to the sword. Because of their failure to be peaceable, they're probably just going to look for other occasions to foment rebellion against you. The women, the little ones, the livestock, everything else in the city and all its spoil, you shall take as plunder for yourself. And though this may seem in our generation to be a very, rather harsh way of dealing with other people, let me just say, just read how the Assyrians carried out their policies of extermination of peoples. Just read the crimes of the Canaanites. Just read the stories of ancient peoples and how they treated other nations when they went to war against it. And you'll understand there's a great deal of mercy being extended here. God is setting out principles that really deal with the prevention of the loss of life. It seems to me that there are two things God's law does. Number one, it has as its principle, don't do harm. Where, you know, do your best to live at peace with people, not to do harm to people. Don't be looking to foment wars. Don't be looking to fight wars of aggression. But where wars do occur, God's concern is to lessen the pain of it. To lessen the pain of it. And so these things that seem to us to be rather shocking in the light of what our sense of what warfare ought to entail, which is basically you don't bother with anybody who's not absolutely involved in the war. You minimize collateral damage. Of course, our enemies in many of these warfares do not abide by our sense of right and wrong, and most nations do not. We have a nation that has been instructed but in Christian values. We want to see limited actions. We want to see limited loss of life. We don't want to see collateral damage and things like that occurred. But in most nations of the world, that's not their sense whatever. It's not their sense whatever. Here God is restraining the nation from doing all this in their heart and say there's certain principles you got to abide by that you just can't go into maximum total war. You have to recognize I have principles to guide you of what you can and what you cannot do with respect to the other nations that would come against you in warfare. And so the women are able to be wives to their men, the livestock, everything else in the city. This is spoil and plunder that they can enjoy as the nation that has subjected another nation under its authority. And thus you shall do to all the cities that are far from you, which are not cities of the nations here. So this is talking about foreign, distant places. But in the cities of these people that the Lord your God has given you for an inheritance, that is the Canaanite nations, we've gone through this before, you shall save nothing alive. These were the nations that were devoted to destruction. And all life in those nations were to be taken. You shall devote them to complete destruction, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, as the Lord your God commanded. And again, we go back to the fact that God gave them 400 years of space for repentance, so the iniquity of the Amorite was full. But now God says he's going to display his wrath in the destruction of these nations. But that was not the law of Israel's relation to all the nations of the world. They were not to be fighting holy wars for the furtherance of their religion. They were not to be engaged necessarily in wars of aggression. They certainly had the right to engage in wars of defense. But where they did engage in these wars, there were certain rules and principles that looked to minimize the loss of life. Not only the loss of life, I think it's an interesting thing that the latter part in verse 19 and following even has some ecological concerns that God has about the land around it. Not only the people in these cities, but look what it says in verse 19. It says, when you besiege a city for a long time, making war against it in order to take it, you shall not destroy its trees by wielding an axe against them. You may eat from them, but you shall not cut them down. Are the trees in the field human that they should be besieged by you? Even have mercy upon the ecology. Don't strip it. Don't strip the land bare. There are other people that are going to come to live there sooner or later once this war is over. Only the trees that you know are not trees for food you may destroy and cut it down. But you may build siege works against the city that makes war with you until it falls. So you can take those trees that aren't fruit-bearing trees so that you can utilize it for the purposes of weaponry and such. But let the trees bearing fruit still bear their fruit, that people might be able to benefit from that. Don't treat them as if they were the enemy. Have a little bit of regard for the ecological, the ecosystem around about you. And so God even gives commands with respect to that. So I think the principles really is, again, even though I know for us, in our sensibilities, it's hard to see just taking the seven nations of Canaan and consuming them under the wrath of God and consigning them all to judgment, and even enemies where you just kill all the males. God says, I want to see what could be lessened. I want to see restraint in this whole enterprise of the wars of this nation. Comments or questions?
Two things. There was no punishment for the men that were afraid to go to war or what, but I guess they couldn't partake of the spoil, probably, when they deceived the city. It doesn't say that, but I'm just, you know, it says, you know, when they do overtake them, that they could take up the spoil. So
yeah,
if they weren't in wild, maybe that would be the only...
Yeah, well, again, I don't think God says there should be punishment for them.
Yeah,
because
but I would think that would be just maybe the one thing that they didn't benefit.
That's true.
They didn't receive the benefit.
Yeah, yeah.
And getting back to the trees, I wonder if the reason only kept fruit trees, because other trees that could make spears and use them for warfare, I don't know why they would otherwise...
He says, you can destroy and cut down that you may build siege works against the city that makes war with you. So you could use the trees that are not fruit-bearing trees for the purposes of making war. But the fruit-bearing trees, leave it alone. Leave it alone. Don't strip the land bare. God has ecological concerns at his heart. I mean, I think that I don't think I'm just looking mono concerns in there, but God's saying these trees are made by him for a purpose of bearing fruit for human consumption. And there's going to be, this war is not going to be a perpetual war. It's interesting. He says, when you besiege a city for a long time, you might say, what's the use? Strip the land bare. We've been at this for a long, long time. God says, no. There's going to be people eventually, once this war is over, who are going to dwell there. Allow the trees to do their work, and don't just strip them bare. Don't just make everything to be something that you use to contribute to the end of war. Again, I don't think the picture is that total war is what Israel is to be giving itself to. Complete and total war, complete and total destruction, complete and total use of everything for the purposes of just feeding the war machine. I think God is telling them, don't do that. There are restrictions and restraints that he sets out. Does that make sense? Any other comments or questions about chapter 20? Yes, Tim.
The question I have is, like, in today's world, we have terrorists and people that their ideology is like, as we've seen this recently. And then those states that foster this type of activity.
Mm-hmm.
Our country, in light of some of these principles, how do we deal with that as a nation? It seems sometimes we strike deals with them, in the hope of, advancing unity, or not unity, but, peace. And
it's misguided. All history shows it's misguided. Because when you have people that that do not abide by the principle of restraint, when all-out war is for them a way of life, and you could put in there the German war machine of the 1940s, you could put in there many of the armies of communism that we fought in the 50s and in the 60s, those people were concerned about all-out warfare. They were not concerned about restraint, and to make deals with such people, you end up only worsening situations because you're giving those people the ability and power to strengthen their war machine rather than looking to engage it, perhaps when there would have been a minimal amount of effort that would be required. I think anybody who knows anything about the Second World War would know that as soon as the Germans, what did they do? They crossed the Rhineland into the, what was it called, the Ruhr. And that was something that the Vienna Convention said they were not to do. If they would have just enforced the conventions of that settled the First World War and said, you've done something you were not to do, then Hitler would have just backed away. And that would have been in the end of it. But he did it with impunity. They did nothing. And he took their measure. And he said, they will not resist me. They will not stop me. And so the next thing was taking the Anschluss of Austria, the taking of the Sudetenland with Czechoslovakia, and then it wasn't until they finally... And it was at that point that Neville Chamberlain went and met with him in Munich and came back with a piece of paper. I don't know if you remember this. He waved the piece of paper saying, peace in our time! Peace in our time! And then I don't know how many weeks will remain before the Blitzkrieg into Poland. But it wasn't long. And at that point, the Germans were beginning their fight against Britain itself in the air war there. And ultimately, it was Chamberlain was taken out of office and Churchill was put in, and with the full resolve to fight him on the beaches, fight him in the air, fight him in the cities, blood, sweat, and tears. And here was someone who was resolved to do what was necessary, but at that point, a lot more needed to be done because they just gave the German war machine time to build. If they had gone in and done what they ought to have done earlier, then we wouldn't have had the terrible battles that World War II brought. But at one point, you got to say, that's enough. That's enough. What these people are doing is brutal. It's this is a nation that is fomenting inhuman procedures and practices, and they're aggressive, and they're looking to take nation after nation after nation, and it was time to go into an all-out battle to defeat Nazism. And it seems to me, whenever we've delayed doing what needs to get done, it always makes the job harder. And I think, you know, what we've seen with ISIS in Iraq is we've given them an ability to take land and open up training bases where they're training people to do the very thing they did in France. And it's like, we don't know this is coming. We didn't know this was coming a year ago, 2 years ago. We knew it. We knew eventually this is what was going to be about. We knew that they were going to be training people and sending them back home, all the people from Europe that had visas to get back to their countries, the Americans who have visas to get back here, and that they would put, and all the warnings were there. They were going to put their terrorist bombers in with the people migrating from Syria to Greece into Europe, and that's exactly the route these guys took. I mean, it didn't take a prophet to know that this was happening. But yet, I think, you know, what you're saying is that these people have this delusion of peace when there is no peace. Peace when there's no basis for peace with people that want to kill you. People who want to kill the maximum amount of people. The only thing you can do with those kinds of people is destroy them. And we might be getting a little bit of a look at Canaanite culture by looking at the face of ISIS. We may be getting a little bit of a look of what God knew was in those people's hearts when you look at the Islamic terrorist who can go into a stadium and just with a smile on his face just start taking life after life after life after life. And there's no remedy for that but destruction. And the people of the leadership of the Western world has to recognize that's what they are fighting against. And for Mr. Obama to say, as he did, we've ended the war on terror. I mean, what does that do? Does it make him feel good? Look at me, I'm the one who ended the war on terror. I don't want to get into politics on this, folks. But the point is, you can make those declarations, but it's not going to change the heart of the people that want to kill you, that are bent upon aggressive advancement of Islam to make you convert or die, to destroy Christian civilizations as they've done. There was a thriving Christian community in Iraq, a thriving Christian community in Syria. And now those people are either dead or are on the run. And their desire is to systematically destroy anything that's not Islamic, anything. And so my answer to you is, it's wrong to make alliances with those that are concerned to kill you. There's no basis for an alliance with such people. And it's distressing that our country feels that this is going to lead to good results. I just don't see it leading to good results. I see that there's going to have to be stand taken in Western culture, likened to what happened in the 14th century, Charles Martel stemming Islam. And I probably got it wrong, the dates, but the final effort of Christians to just say enough is enough with Muslim expansion. It's happened before, and the only answer was to stand in war against them until they retreated. And the wonderful thing is, the experience of all history has been, whenever people have stood up against Islamic aggression and Islamic expansion, they have retreated. They have retreated. There were long spaces of no aggression, even though the mentality of aggression was still present in many hearts. They did not act it out because they knew it would have gained them well, many guns against them, many bullets against them. I mean, suppose everyone in that that music hall where that shooting was take place, every one of those people had guns and were shooting back. What if a hail of bullets were going in the other direction towards these people that were doing the shooting? Well, number one, it would have led to life, loss of life being averted, and secondly, it would have been a clear lesson. You don't do that sort of thing. You just don't do that sort of thing. It will not work. And where there's been firm stand against Islamic aggression, they've always historically backed down. Anyway, so that's my view on that. Anything else? Again, these political questions are hard, they're difficult. Our responsibility is to pray for our leaders and to encourage them to do the right thing. And part of that is governments exist for the protection of the people, for the good, to do good to the righteous, and to they bear not the sword in vain to punish the evildoers. And these people are evildoers, and the sword of vengeance is given to civil authority to destroy them, to go after them, and to bring them to justice. Well, just briefly, we've gotten through chapter 20, chapter 21. I think there's some five different things that are spoken of here. Everything from what do you do when there's unsolved murders, there's blood, innocent blood that's been shed, and you just don't know who did it. Then there's the matter of warfare, where there are female captives that are brought into the family, ways that she's to be treated. And then you have the whole question of bigamy, and two wives, and the rights of the firstborn. Then what do you do with the rebellious son? And then the law with respect to the one who's hung upon a tree being accursed. So you have those five things. We've got about 4 or 5 minutes. Let's just look at the first one. It says, if in the land that the Lord your God has given you to possess, someone is found slain, lying in an open country, and it's not known who killed him, then, here's what the elders are to do. Again, this is the situation. If this happens, then this occurs. Then your elders and your judges shall come out, and they shall measure the distance to the surrounding cities, and the elders of the city that's nearest to the slain, that's the city that's to take the responsibility. And what are they to do? Well, first of all, there's to be atonement. There's to be a heifer that's never been worked. It's not pulled a yoke. The elders of the city will bring the heifer down to the valley with running water, which is neither plowed nor sown, and shall break the heifer's neck there in the valley. Then the priest, the son of Levi, shall come forward. For the Lord your God has chosen them to minister to him and to bless in the name of the Lord. And by their word, every dispute and every assault shall be settled. And all the elders of the city nearest to the slain man shall wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley, and they shall testify, our hands did not shed this blood, nor did our eyes see it shed. Accept atonement, O Lord, for your people Israel, whom you have redeemed, and do not set the guilt of innocent blood in the midst of your people Israel, so that their blood guilt be atoned for. So you shall purge the guilt of innocent blood from your midst when you do what is right in the sight of the Lord. So you have a dead man outside the city. Someone's killed him. It's evident that this is a murder. And you just don't know who did it. And yet there has to be a sense of responsibility that's taken. And there's to be that sense of corporate responsibility that is assumed by the nearest city. There needs to be atonement for this blood that's been shed. There needs to be some justice. But no one's to bear that penalty if they're innocent. So the leaders of the city are to take responsibility. And there's to be atonement made. The heifer's neck is to be broken. And then there's to be the washing of the hands. We're not responsible for this. The declaration of the fact that we're not responsible. We didn't do it. We didn't see who did it. Otherwise, we would arrest him. Otherwise, we would convict him. Otherwise, we would stone him. Lord, accept the atonement. Accept the atonement of the people that you've redeemed, and do not hold us guilty of this innocent blood that's been shed near our city. So there's this ritual that's done so that people know that this life matters. This is not just someone, well, he's just some, what do they use, John Doe. So stick him in the city morgue and throw him at the potter's field. He has importance and dignity so much that the leaders of the city are to do this ritual in order to, again, express the sacredness of human life. That this is not just somebody that's to be taken away secretively and thrown in a potter's field. Responsibility is taken. Even though they've not done it, at least the responsibility of atonement to be made for the blood of this innocent man. And in the midst of priests, in the midst of elders, in the midst of leaders, doing this ritual, again, I think, to highlight the importance of human life in God's sight. Comments, questions, or insights on that incident? Yes?
Am I missing something, or you're not saying that you're going to try to find out who did this?
Well, I'm sure that there's been some investigation on the part of someone prior to this being done, but just at this point, it just isn't known. There's no apparent suspects or nobody really to go after. I'm sure if there was somebody to go after, you'd go after him. The Avenger of Blood would go after him if his identity was known and he was part of a family. But ultimately, you know, law enforcement can do their best, but hey, in any major city, there's unsolved murders left, right, and center. Where it's just not known who committed these acts. And yet there has to be some kind of public acknowledgement of this loss of life and the importance of it. I think in a lot of places that's not understood. Life is cheap. And this was a ritual done to show that no, life is not cheap. It means something. This is blood shed in the presence of God, and that blood cries out to him for judgment, and some atonement must be made. This ritual must be gone through to enshrine the sacredness of this life that has been lost not far from the city. Okay?
It does say something about, and by their word, every dispute and every assault shall be settled.
So yes.
I think maybe that's just reference to that, you know.
Yes.
They're trying to settle, but they're responsible to find out who's done it. Right?
Yes. They were administers in one aspect of public justice in this regard. But again, if they didn't know who it was, they didn't know who it was. You know, God did not, at least at this point, give them the means of disclosure. He didn't give them something to do that the identity of the murderer would be disclosed. So it just had to be left with this public action done for the sake of the community expressing its outrage, expressing the need of atonement, and the need of pleading God's mercy in the light of the blood that was shed, the innocent blood that was shed in close proximity to their city. Tom?
Yeah, the text uses the atonement, you know, and the word blood given, innocent blood, you know, so it still seems that there's a purging of that guilt for innocent blood and that calling upon God to not hold this city blood guilty.
Yes.
You know, so there is still, you know, some guiltiness that's associated with, for lack of any witness, of that city that's the nearest one. So somehow, you know, they have a guiltiness to them.
Yes.
And they're crying to God, you know, to be released from that. And this atonement, you know, there still needs to be an atonement for that blood. I think if nothing, we can look to the atonement of Christ for innocent blood and say, well, you know, we look to Christ for atonement.
Yeah.
That we would be innocent. That's the most nearest parallel I can draw from this. But somehow there's a guiltiness associated to that city somehow.
Yeah, well, the city takes responsibility for the public display of the seriousness of this crime. Yeah, I think that's really the heart Because these laws are meant to make the people sensitive to the wrongdoing that's been done, to not allow them to just we just cover it over as a private thing. It's made a public thing. It's made a public enactment of outrage, and God's justice could well come to the city. But if, let's say, the city's hiding the killer, but they're coming forward and saying, "Lord, as far as we know, we're not hiding him. We didn't do it. We didn't see who did it. Don't hold us accountable. Accept the atonement we made." I think that's that. So it serves to heighten their awareness of the sin of murder, and also it heightens their awareness of the need of blood atonement to cover up the blood guiltiness. Now, if the murderer is ultimately disclosed, even though atonement's made, still he's subject to public justice. But at least at this point, they don't know who the murderer is, and so this enactment is to be done, I think, for the purposes of the atonement made for the city and for the heightening of the sense of the people's knowledge of just how evil violations of the command of murder is. Our time is gone as I'm looking at the clock, so let's commit our thoughts to the Lord as we go to Him in prayer. Father, we are so thankful for this portion of Your Word that, though it contains many things difficult and hard to be understood, yet, Lord, it does set out so much of Your heart's concern for righteousness and Your heart's concern for the importance of the sanctity of human life, and even in the way You guided the nation so that many of the horrors that were so so endemic or so widely done by the other nations would not be done in the midst of the nation of Israel. Lord, be pleased to help us to consider these things, give us understanding. Be pleased, Lord, now to bless us as we greet one another this morning, as we have a time of fellowship together, as we enter into morning worship. Give us hearts, we plead, to sing Your praises as we come and we ask for these mercies. In Jesus' name, amen.